where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government, based in the capital Sana'a, has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014. And we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors, except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say, our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protests through Brussels on Friday was organised by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least €20 billion for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to
raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for a law as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. In this edition, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the United States right now on an official visit to meet with President Joe Biden and also to address Congress. This is his first foreign trip since the Russian military operation. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the different aspects of his visit and the significance of it. Our guest, Fiorella Isabel, journalist and political analyst, is joining us from Moscow, and also Ray McGovern, who is a former CIA analyst, who also will be sharing his views regarding this recent development.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with Fiorella Isabel. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the U.S. right now. The U.S. has been Ukraine's most important ally in the war, committing more than $50 billion worth of assistance so far, more than any other country. What does this trip, as Zelensky's first foreign trip since the Russian military operation, signify?
Well, this signifies clearly that the United States and its NATO allies are not stopping anytime soon in pushing this proxy war against Russia. And they're, of course, continuing to utilize Ukraine as the excuse, but everybody knows this is really not the case. I mean, Ukrainians are themselves suffering right now, and so are Americans. This is a point I do want to bring up pretty quickly here. I mean, this is just after the United States Congress passed $858 billion defense budget, which is really an offensive budget when we're talking about these weapons that will be used to give Ukraine what they see as a level up. But as we know so far, Russia has maintained its strength in this whole special military operation. And the reality is this money is basically going into places that the public does not know where this money is going. It's going into a lot of pockets. It's going into Zelensky. It's going into weapons for, of course, funding the far right Nazi, neo-Nazi Azov battalion. And this has not really made a difference thus far. What is the United States thinking in continuing to do this? And I think it's continuing to do this because the American public has not at all responded enough. I mean, you have record high inflation, over 7% inflation. You have sales right now, it's Christmas time, down in retail because people can't afford to shop. You have a housing crisis, you have a homelessness crisis, you have all these problems domestically. And yet, of course, all this money and billions more will be given to Zelensky. That is what has been stated so far by the Western media, that Zelensky will be given some money. And this is Christmas time. So it's the juxtaposition really shows that the United States is willing to go to the last Ukrainian, but also perhaps to the last European and to the last American at this point, where all of the resources and the focus, instead of being focused at home, are focused abroad with Ukraine and this sort of using Christmas time to say, well, we have to help Ukraine. I think that's also a part of it as well.
Well, Ray, Fiorella just pointed to a number of different aspects regarding this visit, but something I'd like to pinpoint here is the word proxy that Fiorella used, a proxy war now. And also in a speech to the defense chiefs just a few hours ago, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said that his country is fighting against NATO forces in Ukraine. And of course, we see that Zelensky is in Washington right now. So what is your take on this?
Well, the timing of the visit is very important and very significant. The Congress is turning over. The House is now going to be ruled by the Republicans at the turn of the year. And so here are the Democrats trying to pour or to shoot or to fire hose still more money into Ukraine. Now, as has been pointed out, that money doesn't go into Ukraine. It goes into the pockets of the CEO of Lockheed or Raytheon, the arms merchants that Pope Paul called the bloodstained members of the arms trade. This is what's driving this, plus the fact that the Democrats want to go on record as having done everything they can for as long as they could to save Ukraine and have it meet the Russian onslaught. Now, Russian onslaught is not going to be met. Zelensky is going to ask for lots more money. He'll get $45 billion more, but he won't get enough tanks. He won't get enough artillery. He won't get enough personnel, armored personnel carriers to make a difference. What he's asking for, what his defense minister asked for, is 300 brand new tanks, 500 brand new pieces of howitzers, real effective artillery, and 700 armored personnel carriers. He's not going to get that. And so what does this politically mean? It means that the Democrats can go out from control of the House saying, we did everything we could. Now when the Republicans come in, it is inevitable, short of the use of nuclear weapons, that the Russians are going to run over Ukraine. So part of it is a domestic political calculation. The other part, and this is for what it's worth, my insight from watching the rhetoric lately. 8 weeks ago, President Putin said, you know, Odessa, right on the Dnieper River, we haven't conquered that yet. And the question is whether it could be a Yabloko Razdora, Russian for an apple of discord. If you know your Greek mythology, you know that the apple of discord started the Trojan War, for God's sake, right? It could be a Yabloko Razdora, or it could be a way into negotiations. It could be a way into making sure, how did I put it here? I have it written down because these words are really important. A way of resolving differences, okay? So what he's saying here is that, in my view, Odessa. I can take Odessa, and the Russians can take Odessa quite readily, but I'm willing to stop there, okay? I'm willing to make that not an apple of discord, but a way of getting into negotiations. In my view, the Russians don't want to take all of Ukraine. That would just be a big bother for them. Now, if they get no response in terms of a willingness to really negotiate, they are going to take Odessa. They're going to take everything to Moldova, all the way to Romania, really, in the south. Do they want that? I don't think so. That's a lot to defend. So here is the United States coming back and saying, no, we're not going to negotiate on this. And you people in Britain, you people who read The Economist, don't get wobbly on the war here. We're here for the duration. We're here for as long as it takes. That makes it very different, very difficult, very dangerous, because the people running our war are adolescents, really, and they could get into a temper tantrum to involve even heavier, even more worrisome weapons if this thing is not stopped.
So, Fiorella, since Ray mentioned what Zelensky might be demanding in during this trip, let's also mentioned that ahead of his trip to Washington, in a briefing, the White House has confirmed that there is going to be a new package worth nearly $2 billion, again, security assistance for Ukraine. And this one also includes Patriot missiles. So what do these Patriot missiles mean?
Well, I mean, this is just more weaponry for Ukraine. But what's been pointed out, and I think Ray did allude to it, is the fact that this is a new phase of this war where it could go either way. Either there's going to be some sort of compromise, and Russia has been openly diplomatic about this whole situation. They have at every turn tried to say, "Hey, we are willing to negotiate, but this has to be fair. It can't be this sort of like, oh, you just have to release every single territory back to Ukraine, including including the ones that have already asked to be a part of the Russian Federation, like Crimea, for a long time." And Crimea has been, of course, another point of contention. But I think this is definitely more so related to the rhetoric that the West, particularly the United States, is leading with Patriot missiles that are directly going to be far more sadistic towards Russia, ramping up this rhetoric that it's going to be any different. And the reality is Russia's military is superior in those terms, and they also have the terrain. They have said that the holidays aren't going to put a stop into what is happening. But when you talk about Odessa, when you talk about a point of perhaps peace and cooperation, we have that opportunity here. I just don't see the U.S. taking it in a way that Russia accepts it. And Russia has long said this: we're not going to accept anything less than this. And I agree with Ray that this doesn't mean that Russia wants to continue to expand westward. They had no intention of doing that. Neither does the army militarily nor politically do they have this intention of doing that. It is far too much terrain to cover. It is far too problematic, and it was never the intention. What was the intention, of course, was denazifying and protecting the people of Donbass. Obviously, that has shifted because of the situation at hand, where the constant supply of weapons to Ukraine will be met with opposition by Russia. And I think we're going to see going into the next month and the next couple months is that Russia is going to really ramp up as Ukraine has continued shelling the Donbass, killing civilians. You're going to see another push by Russia. And a lot of the criticism on Putin and Russia from a lot of the people that have been really watching this is they have been far too diplomatic and far too hesitant in taking what needs to be done, things that people are seeing could have been done for a long time. And these missiles just kind of show overtly that the United States does have NATO troops in embedded, obviously, in Russian territory. Russia has said there are already troops in the Russian Federation. So the criticism is, why isn't Russia then? They said if that happened, they were going to respond. There needs to be a response. And I think we're going to see that response in some way to this, not just the rhetoric and what the United States is doing, but just to the moment here. And there will probably be more opportunities for cooperation and for negotiations. But if Russia doesn't get the bare minimum guarantees, they're not going to accept the word of the U.S. and its NATO allies, because that word has been crushed and trampled on so many times. And I think what we're seeing here is the next phase of the special military operation from the Russian perspective, where it's going to be extremely decisive. And we could potentially see the conflict dwindle down. But I just think that the West is really just keen on keeping this process going for as long as possible, extending the war for as long as possible, so it doesn't look like it's losing. So it looks like, oh, well, this is just going to, you know, kind of dwindle off, instead of this is an outright defeat.
So, Ray, before we discuss this more from Russia's perspective, you did mention the issue of Republicans and Democrats. And we do know that Zelensky will be addressing Congress. Why do you think he will be going there? What are the issues that he might want to raise?
Well, the Congress, unfortunately, is captivated by the predominant narrative, which has Zelensky winning. Of all things, nothing could be farther from the truth. And the Democrats still rule the House. And I understand that Nancy Pelosi has asked every single Democrat, make sure they be there, okay? So this be a test. Do you stand up to the Russians or do you not, okay? They will applaud all of them, including people who voted against the war on Iraq, for God's sake, like Barbara Lee from California. It's unanimous. And so what's in that for the Democrats? Well, down the road, and I think there are enough people who appreciate this, Russia has escalatory dominance there. Look at the map. Russia is going to win probably by this coming spring. The Republicans in the House will be faced with the tough decision as to, as long as it takes, what does it take? Nuclear weapons? I don't think so. So the Republicans will attenuate the conflict, and they will take the rap for not persisting for as long as it takes and being weak on Russia, the mortal sin that can never be forgiven.
Okay, so Fiorella, let's go back to analyzing this from Russia's perspective. Russian President Vladimir Putin has recognized that there has been the tragedy of loss of life, but he also pointed out that this was inevitable. What does he mean by that?
Well, I mean, this is a war, right? I mean, it's what I mean. Russia considered this a special military operation, but with a constant supply of weapons from the U.S., the EU, and their NATO allies to Ukraine. Ukraine is basically being held up like a puppet with strings being pulled by NATO, particularly the United States, as the puppeteer master. And so in fighting this special military operation, there are going to be, unfortunately, a loss of life, and that is the ugliness of war. I believe that's also part of the hesitation for Russia, other than the economic factors and that it's in a different position now than it was years ago when the conflict began in 2014. This now is obviously has expanded to not just protecting the Donbass and denazifying these areas, but protecting itself, its existence as Russia, as what it is. Russia is fighting an existential battle to exist, because we know from the RAND documents, we know from U.S. Statesmen that the United States and NATO's plan was all along was to break up Russia using the its own previous Soviet territories, using its own people against it, using its allies against it, creating chaos in the Balkan area, creating chaos in the Caucasus in order to, of course, destabilize the region, sanctioning Russia. We know right now that the EU just passed new sanctions. I believe it's ninth set of sanctions against Russia. And it's trying to basically attack now Russian media and anything that is affiliated with Russia or the Russian government. And that is, of course, targeting its assets. I mean, this is not stopping anytime soon. So what Russia is fighting is an existential war. And I think a lot of people have jumped on that in a way and have looked to the Russian Federation as, wow, they're standing up to the Goliath and they are going into this. And unfortunately, what is what ends up being war or a military operation is going to cause the loss of life of both Russians and Ukrainians. But let's not pretend that the majority of the loss of life is coming from Ukraine and the weapons supplied to it by the West, constantly shelling their own civilians, their own people in the Donbass. And if you look at Western media, you will see, oh, Russians are continuing to shell Ukrainians in every single headline. Journalism is essentially near dead in the West because you don't have journalistic integrity. We almost started World War III because the AP jumped on a story from a source that wasn't verified because of this. So in essence, yes, a war is always going to bring a loss of life. But what I think Putin is referring to is this is going to be minimal in comparison to what could happen if NATO continues to expand and continues coming in. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is like wanting to surround Russia's border now with Finland and Sweden. So there has to be a pushback. And this is, again, a push towards the existence of Russians as a whole. Putin is definitely not in terms of the way we view nationalism in the West, but in terms of a very patriotic statesman. You know, he's not a communist, but he comes from the Soviet era. He's trying to protect the integrity of Russia, of what it is and what it has been, its culture and every aspect of it. And the only way to do that is to stand up to Western hegemony. And that's what we're seeing before us.
Okay, so Fiorella, we're running out of time. A quick answer. What are the prospects of peace at this point right now?
They seem very...
Fiorella.
Sorry, yeah. Oh,
just
me.
Quickly.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see that for at least the next few months.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Ray, we don't have that much time left. The final question is yours. The monthly cost of defense for Ukraine is reportedly around $5 billion. Who exactly is benefiting from this war?
The war profiteers, the people who sell and make the weapons, and the Congress people who profit from the contributions. I'd like to say one more thing. Obama himself, 6 years ago, said, Ukraine is a core interest to Russia. It's not a core interest to the United States. And Russia has escalatory dominance there. Whoa, what's changed? Nothing has changed except one thing, and that is China. Nobody mentions China in this connection. The Chinese and Russians just began a whole week of naval exercises in the East China Sea. There's escalatory dominance there as well. If the Russians ever get in trouble in Ukraine, watch out for what happens in the South China, East China Sea, and across from Taipei. Does the U.S. really want to get involved in a war on two fronts with two other superpowers? It shouldn't, but the people running our policy are so sophomoric that they may throw a tantrum and get us into precisely that kind of threat.
Thank you very much, Eric McGovern, a former CIA analyst, and Fiorella Isabel, journalist and political analyst. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Europe got hit by roughly $1 trillion from surging energy costs in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the deepest crisis in decades is only getting started. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, EU member states have spent roughly $1 trillion in the face of the bloc's worst energy crisis in decades, Bloomberg is reporting, citing calculations based on market data. Soaring energy prices have sent its economies plunging into recession as most member states opted to stop importing gas from Russia, facing the necessity to turn to more expensive supplies. The agency highlighted that the total estimated losses marks just the beginning of a full-scale crisis, as a period of high prices for energy could last years, while aid is already becoming unaffordable. The security of energy supply is expected to remain an issue beyond next winter, after the filled gas storage facilities across the region are emptied.
The nations of the EU will have to refill their gas reserves for the next cold season with no deliveries from Russia, which also heats up competition for tankers. Even with more import terminals for liquefied natural gas LNG coming online, the crisis will reportedly loosen its grip only in 2026, when additional production capacity from the US or Qatar becomes available. At the same time, prices should remain high to attract LNG away from other buyers, from energy-hungry Asian buyers. A state of emergency could linger for years, according to Brussels-based think tank Bruegel, as quoted by Bloomberg. Once you add everything up, bailout subsidies, it is a ridiculously large amount of money, Martin Devenish, a director at consultancy SRM, told the agency, adding it's going to be a lot harder for governments to manage this crisis next year. A rush to fill storage during summer, despite all-time high prices, has softened the supply squeeze so far. However, freezing weather is expected to give the region's energy system the real test this winter. Last month, Germany's energy regulator, the Federal Network Agency, warned that German households and small businesses have failed their first gas-saving test. The regulator noted that a reduction in consumption of at least 20% was required to avoid a gas shortage in the coming month. Meanwhile, Guardian reported the UK is falling far behind EU countries in its performance and policies on home insulation and energy efficiency, and will lose further ground if retained laws from the European Union are scrapped. According to a new study, the report by UK pressure group Another Europe is Possible and Germany's respected Friedrich Ebert Foundation says the UK is failing to match new EU laws, which aim to double the annual rate of building renovation and reduce primary energy consumption by 39% by 2030. It says that with UK household electricity prices about 30% higher than its neighbouring EU countries, the UK has a lack of ambition to match such targets, despite the price pressures. An additional threat is posed, it goes on, by the UK government's plan to take thousands of EU laws of the statute book by the end of next year, which will further widen parts of this country. The report's author, David Baldock, senior fellow at the Institute for European Environmental Policy, said, "Our sky-high energy prices mean that we have a clear interest in getting the most out of what we use. But the UK government's energy efficiency and home insulation agenda continues to lack ambition. This is said to be a key area of UK-EU divergence in the years ahead, as the EU commits its member states to bold targets on efficiency and insulation. Divergence is a two-way street. It can mean getting rid of existing EU rules we have inherited from membership, but it can also mean not keeping up with changes the EU is making now. We see both of these happening in UK-EU environmental regulation. Devolution adds another level of complexity because, in different ways, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are all likely to stay closer to EU status quo. Overall, it's a mixed picture with elements of divergence going alongside the expensive duplication of existing EU arrangements without much substantive change. But if the retained EU law bill is not substantially amended, it could see thousands of EU-derived laws taken out of the UK statute book by the end of next year, risking chaos and potentially radical deregulation. A Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy spokesperson said improving the energy efficiency of homes is important to tackling fuel poverty and reducing emissions. And that's why we have committed £6.6 billion this Parliament and a further £6 billion to 2028 to make buildings more energy efficient. The Energy Company Obligation Scheme alone has delivered improvements to around 2.4 million homes, and just last month we launched our £1 billion Eco Plus scheme to accelerate these efforts, installing measures in households who have previously not been able to access eco support, he said. Recently, the department unveiled a new energy efficiency campaign to help people reduce usage and bills.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.